Okay, we are back for show 287. Joe, yes. How you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim, but I was going to mention just a kind of a description and salutation to the miserable Ukrainians trapped in Bakhmut. This is the current big battle of the Ukrainian war, and the Ukrainians are being slaughtered. And I just wanted to mention them because they are sort of forgotten, even by the independent media, which irks me no end. What you're looking at is, of course, just an absolute controlled genocide. If you look at the tactics that Zelensky and his general corps are using in Bakhmut, it is designed not to hold on to the city, but just to produce the highest body count of European Ukrainians. And there was a quote from Zelensky, which sort of gave a clarification of all this. And he said that, we want to make sure that that the Russians pay with blood for every foot of Ukraine that they win,
Whose blood? Whose blood?
Right, I know. But anyway, my point is that, we've talked many times about the artificial nature of World War I and all the wars, frankly, but, specifically World War I, where you had, Masons behind both cohorts across the trenches from one another with pistols shooting people who would retreat. And then they would just drive them into one another for population reduction. And this was such a crime and has not really been exposed that well. And here it is happening again. This is just absolutely real time. It's the same thing that occurred in World War I. And it is just a shame to me that the independent media hasn't caught on to this concept. It's there are a few people that are mentioning it, but not enough. It should be the same level of attention that the depop agenda of the vaccine received from the independent media. So anyway, I'm just mentioning these individuals who are trapped inside this area. They between like maybe 3,000 and 15,000 of them. God knows how many are going to get out, but there is no military or, there's just no reason for the way that the battle is being waged other than to produce the biggest Ukrainian body count imaginable. And so anyway, I would just hope that people who, notice this would ask other independent media commenters to take a position on this, have a stand.
Well, I suppose the strategy or the intent is to run up the supposed body count of civilians as a PR move against Putin, and perhaps to create a land without a people for people who evidently want more land.
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
ethnic cleansing, perhaps.
It's just ludicrous.
They're eyeing the rich soil and the gas reserves, Blackwater. Yeah. I mean, not Blackwater.
BlackRock.
BlackRock has designs on it, So.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be just chopped up into bits. We talked about this last week of Mo Linsky, who has, started this whole ball rolling with putting Zelensky into power. This is it's just an obvious puppet. This is just ludicrous. His qualifications are the fact that he had a TV role as president. He has no background, neither military or politics. And so this is an artificial construction. People should look at it in the same way they looked at the rationale for the vaccine. This is just going to lead to a lot of dead bodies. So, the idea that this is in any way trying to help or preserve the Ukraine is ludicrous. I mean, what is Ukraine? Is it it's like a plot of land? I mean, it's the people. And the people are basically being genocide. Half or more than half have left. And the idea of, you know, what number, you know, of death that has been, can be attributed to the war is just incalculable. Probably about 1 million people, I would think, already. Probably about 300 dead just out of casualties from the war, and then maybe another 700 from just misery, malevolence, starvation, just, you know, sickness. I mean, everything else heaped on top of these poor people. And of course, no one is counting any of this. The only thing you hear in the media is, you know, the glory of the battle and, you know, how they're going to fight the Russians in the trenches. The Western media is repeating its role of the New York Times during the Holodomor. Obviously, they're just creating, you know, an artificial reality to stem public opinion. So how does it ever end? Well, Tim, the only way it ends is if, you know, NATO can be dismantled, which means we've got to dismantle the political class.
Yeah. And of course, NATO is the cause of the war, NATO expansion, of course.
Yeah.
You know, that was the coup back in 2000. The war began as far back as 2014 when the U.S. Installed their puppet regime, Victoria Nuland. And then, of course, the constant bombardment of Donetsk, the Russian ethnic Russians in the Ukraine. The idea that, you know, that somehow we can, the West can take Ukraine and Russia's going to tolerate it without some sort of conflict was absurd. Of course, they got the war that they wanted, and they're willing to spill every last drop of Ukrainian blood to string it out. To what end? No one seems to know. It's, you know, win it to win it. What are you going to win? I love these phrases.
Yeah.
Oh, give it all that it takes. Well, what is it? You know,
what takes the Ukrainian people?
Yeah,
they're being sacrificed. And then past this, then you have the question of who's going to own the land. Well, I would imagine the Russians will own the Donbass, probably all the way to Odessa. And then the other areas will be owned by Molinsky and BlackRock and anyone else who gets in on the...
Yeah, they may call it Ukraine, but it's going to be run by Jews.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sad situation, no. But there are parallels to it in many other countries, I'm afraid.
So, obviously, the solution was, you know, a buffer state. That's reasonable in any situation when you have two sides, you want a buffer state, and that's how you keep the peace, but they didn't want to keep the peace. That's why they kept pressing east. You know, since you know, the late 90s. So they, you know, it was a line that they crossed, and they knew they were crossing it. So,
yeah, one day
anyone can look at a map and look at the situation.
Yeah, you know, what it'd be someday maybe we should do a show on the NATO's eastern expansion. You know, because all of these little stories, you know, Georgia, Belarus, even the beginning of the situation in the Ukraine, all of them are really quite interesting, and they create such a very clear-cut pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that NATO and the color revolution, and the thing that's quite interesting is that you can actually look at Western media. It wasn't as controlled then, and they called out the color revolutions in very clear language as to being funded and controlled by NATO.
Yeah.
So, you know, and of course, In the case of Russia, you have to remember that after they funded the overthrow of the regime in Georgia, the puppet they put in, I forget his name, he immediately, you know, they armed him and he attacked Russia immediately.
Oh, Shalashkashvili.
Right, that's right. Yeah,
he was like a lawyer or something in the war. Yeah. He was like a lawyer in New York or something.
Right. They gave him a few tanks and he goes to the front and he attacked Russia. So when NATO kept creeping closer and when they were about to, you know, make NATO, Ukraine part of the organization, I mean, what would you do if you're Russia? Putin is unfortunately just a very rational actor. And I'm afraid that, you know, because he has to make a case to his public, and they have created a construction in which Putin can make the perfect case to his people of why they have to keep up the war. I mean, it's obviously rational.
The Russians, it's existential.
It's existential, right. So yeah. He has that to make sure that his half of the slaughter is supported by
and
the
he can point at a map and go, look, see, it's existential.
Yeah, they're coming right at us. Right.
it's like they're on our doorstep. I mean,
and then in the West, it's kind of actually kind of funny because if you look at the construction, Putin has the rationale. Right. He has a really strong rationale. You heard the speech he gave a few weeks ago. Well, on our side of the equation, we have propaganda.
Yes, we have like Bernaysian propaganda.
I mean, it just shows you that when
there's a painting of Putin, like King Kong holding a woman or something, like World War.
Right, exactly. But I mean, when you are the weak half of the intellectual, you know, kind of median, where the other group needs to have some reason given to them, and that's Russia. And your group can just deal with you with propaganda. You're very intellectually feeble.
Even from what I gather, even the Russian audience can sit down and listen to like an hour and a half speech with rational arguments that are like stupid emotional, illogical appeals, like our State of the Union, like our President of the Union, just one lie or emotional appeal after another, you know, one logical fallacy. It just doesn't make any sense. You're like, and you're, well, this speech is, you just know your Putin's speech. Well, this is dry and clear and makes sense.
Yeah.
He's treating me like an adult when he speaks.
Did you see the audience that Putin was addressing? I'm not sure what it was. It was perhaps the combined legislature.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, gosh, they were good looking. I mean, there wasn't a single transgender or, you know, kind of surgical creation in the entire lot that I could see. They
like the freak show on like our freak show on Capitol Hill.
Right. I mean, well, our freak show. I mean, where, you know, it's not just, I know, don't mean to single the transgender out as being unattractive. I mean, you look at just the physical makeup of our, you know, Congress. I mean, some, they are just, they're suffering, you know, from toxicity. They're overweight, they're flaccid. I mean, Lindsey Graham is sort of like the Charles Atlas of this crew. You know, it's just, they are just weak, you know, whereas the Russian group just struck me as being, you know, healthy. So,
well, they're also very old for the most part and very silly. Yeah. People, at least the leadership is.
Well, Mitch O'Connell.
Biden all the way down. Yeah. Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. You have Biden, Mitch O'Connell. I mean, is this what you want leading the nation? I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know,
well, one thing that this whole thing is sort of the isolation and insularity of our political class. They obviously live in a very tightly controlled, you know, bubble, or, you know, where the narrative is structured in a way. They're not getting are they really getting the information? I'm sure that they can access the information, but whoever's feeding them the information, whoever's pulling the issues, like the President of the United States, the Chief of Staff, you know, what's his name, Zients or something, he claimed another Jew, he's going to control the information that goes to the President, to the extent the President is making any independent decisions. Obviously that he is not. He's obviously suffering from dementia. You know, Kamala Harris is a you know, whatever she is, you know, fool. You know, and so that's our political class. And they're not, are they really assessing the situation? Do they really have a grasp on reality? You know, they come across as being completely insane, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Putin comes across having a strong grasp of reality. Our political class, in my opinion, is a clown world designed to demoralize the American public.
So the foreign policy isn't pursuing interest for the American. It's like, it's the Kagans, it's Victoria Nuland are controlling foreign policy. So you have this neocon Jewish cult is controlling foreign policy, and it apparently is dedicated to brinkmanship and trying to provoke a war. You are getting some pushback. We talked about the past couple of weeks from the Pentagon, I think from Milley, who's saying that this, you know, they can't win. They got to, you know, at some point they got to negotiate, because they're pushing it so far that the Pentagon and the brass and the military industrial complex might be realizing that, you know, how they're, you know, they're destroying, you know, their gravy train by pushing it as far.
Yeah. And also it'll wake up the American people if it keeps going too long, because I really don't think, unless I am wrong, I would suggest people listen to Brian Berletic, the new Atlas. He goes into these details quite a bit, but as best I can determine, you know, since we deindustrialized, we just cannot match the Russian output in terms of munitions. And we just don't have any factories set up. It would take years, evidently, to get these things rolling. And so we've really been defanged. And this, of course, exposes NATO as just being ludicrous. If it can't even, you know, win a tank battle against a proxy tank battle against Russia, I mean, they can't even get 100 tanks organized to give to these people, even though it's at this point, it's a flat out proxy war. I mean, Samantha Power, you know, she was, if you caught that this week, she said, we're at war with Russia, with the Ukrainians right now doing the fighting using our weapons.
Yeah, she's Cass Sunstein's
wife. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and she's apparently stirring up trouble in Hungary. She's some NGO out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, they will. You know, their purpose and their tactics are, you know, one and the same, and we know they're going to be there trying to get us onto the battlefield or get us into some kind of vaccine mandate situation. And this is all that they do. They're at this point, the bloodlust of this crowd to end the existence of Europeans is just, you know, is pretty ferocious. You know, they're attacking in every imaginable way. You know, so this was, as I said many times, the future is going to be a fight. You know, have to be prepared.
This week, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot lost the primary. I mean, she loses the election. She only got 16% of the vote, just over 16% of the vote. Yeah. Of course, she blamed racism and her gender for her landslide defeat. I guess it wasn't the exploding crime, you know, but she was, wasn't she the first, I forget, was she the first openly lesbian mayor or was the first black female lesbian mayor?
I think she was a combo. She was the first openly black.
Okay. Openly
black. Openly lesbian black woman attorney of Chicago. And she did a terrific job. I mean, literally one of the worst mayors in the history of the world. You know, we talked about Chicago having debased legal system, you know, with these new no incarceration with bails laws. Yeah. that came in effect, and people were wondering how this is going to work. I've got the first little dump of data, which is, you know, Lori's kind of final hurrah here in Chicago. this is you're going to kill you.
Oh, by the way, she has a Jewish spouse.
You know, I don't know if that person. I don't know if Edelman is Jewish. I've heard of this on the internet. I tried to research that. I don't know if she is or not. She could be. I think she kind of. But it's interesting. She's just in the background. But let me just give you the stats here. So, Chicago police data points to a 61% increase in crime for the first 3 weeks of 2023 compared to last year. There were 4,844 serious crime reports within the time frame compared to 3,013 during the same time frame last year. Now, bear in mind, Tim, last year, the city was a failed zone of civilization. The violence was literally driving out all business, the middle class. I mean, it was becoming uninhabitable. Here, you have a 61% increase in crime year over year. So what is the future of Chicago at this point?
Yeah, I think both homicides, mostly from gun violence, spiked in 2020, then dipped a little bit in 2021, like 14%, then shooting up again for 2022. Of course, 2020 was, you know, the year of Floyd and all that nonsense. Violent crime in the city spiked for 40% since she promised to end the epidemic of gun violence. So how's that gone? And she claims that all crime is down. Of course, she just lies about that.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
That I know. This isn't in relationship to reality.
Yeah, like she doesn't have to deal in reality. You know, she's just a bizarre. Wasn't she the one who said she wasn't going to ask questions from white reporters or something?
Yeah, she's been really kind of violent and aggressive against not only whites, but there's this one Latino guy that she had a really vicious correspondent. I mean, like exchange with.
Oh Raymond, yeah, that's when she cussed him out. Yeah.
Yeah, the 15th ward, you know, Edelman, and he. You know, what he was saying is, look, you know, you've got to get some more cops on the street because my people, meaning he was talking about gangbangers, Latino gangbangers. He says, you know, they're going to take to the streets to defend themselves if this thing keeps going. And she, it was obscenity, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this was almost, you know, kind of the end of the facade of civility in American politics. I mean, it was really quite shocking and very important to watch that exchange, because Lightfoot was so vicious and obscene. I mean, you're just using, you know, really obscene language. So, you know, it can come across as clown world, but I mean, in that case, it was really just like a Mad Max kind of situation where, you know, I mean, you could imagine at the next, you know, council meeting, there'd be gunplay between, you know, the various people. It's just, so the country is, you know, well, the country, I mean, the cities have really fallen into a steep decline because, you know, of the mayors. And Tim, if you don't mind, I will give a little personal anecdote, my visit to San Francisco this week.
Oh, yeah. Well, first thing, the DA there is Kim Fox, who's Soros' attorney, DA, who's contributed greatly to the crime explosion by not prosecuting any crime.
Right. I know. Well, that's right. I mean, so this, again, this is a Soros DA zone, and you know, you have everything imaginable. Well, I was in another one, even though they actually got rid of the Soros-funded DA about 6 months ago in a recall. I don't know much about the current one, but hasn't done a lot to in crime, because I was a victim.
Oh.
Yeah. My car was, the windows were smashed in, and they popped my trunk. They knew how to open it up, the trunk, after smashing through the window, so they could get at the trunk, where they were able to make off with my book, Shakespeare's Restless World. So, I mean, I swear. So anyway, but I mean, to fix, you know, on these cars, you know, they smash a window.
Yes,
you know,
that's gonna
$1,000, you know, to get it fixed. And then also, you know, there was just all this shrapnel, glass was all over the place. And then I'll tell you, it didn't do much for our spirits. You know, we'd gone up there to see friends.
You think these are white supremacists that did this?
I'm sure. I mean, you know, you walk around San Francisco, that's one of, you really see the problem of white supremacy. There's no question, because there are whites. But the idea of there being supremacy, or the promotion of supremacy, Tim, most of the whites, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. A lot of the whites that I saw were living in tents. And of that, a large fraction looked like they were narcotized in the extreme. I saw people face down in the sidewalk and in the gutter. Now, I will say, I'll be quite honest about it. San Francisco looked pretty good. And this is not because of the government. It's just that humanity heals itself and restores normalcy, you know, whenever it's possible. And they are, you know, you can see that they are kind of organized to push the homeless camps to particular areas. And in most of the areas, 95% of the areas, it's just like San Francisco always is, which is, you know, kind of a left wing multicultural clump, you know, but it's got, you know, functioning restaurants and people are walking the street unafraid, I would say, for the most part. But white supremacy, nah, I didn't see a lot of that.
Chicago has the same white supremacy problem.
They do, same problem. Very similar. Well, Lori mentioned it, you know, it's like the, this is a...
Well, apparently that's who voted against her, all the whites that control the city.
Yeah, actually, the people who the runoff between the two candidates will not be much of an improvement over Lightfoot.
Well, yeah, the problems are deeper, obviously, than Lori Lightfoot in Chicago and many other cities. You know, like I said, at this point, that the problems vexing Chicago, San Francisco, Minnesota, you know, the nation, probably nothing that electoral politics can handle directly. It's, you know, all the problems that are, all the solutions that are, of course, politically feasible aren't going to do anything, and of course, all the solutions that are necessary aren't politically feasible at this point.
Right. Well, what's happening is actually the solution in and of itself. The people who are interested in civilization are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and then what you'll have are these, you know, kind of dystopian clumps with no tax base, that will be voting reparations for themselves, you know, with no capacity whatsoever to pay it. So I don't know what to say. It was a kind of a upsetting trip because, you know, we went up there to see friends and then we get our car smashed and it was, you have theory and then you have the streets. So we've got a problem in America.
The Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL weighed in on the Scott Adams controversy. He sent out a tweet that said, Adams' remarks about the Black community are flat out racist and should be condemned by all, period. I believe in council culture, so I hope he'll apologize and work to educate himself. But he seems to be doing the exact opposite. I don't know what re-education he has in mind for Mr. Adams, but of course the ADL condemns Scott Adams for being racist. Of course, ADL, who say on the website that Palestinians and Jews cannot coexist happily in a state, and therefore separate states. They're not for integration in Israel.
No, of course not. And it's not separate states. They just want them in some kind of
yes
non-legal, basically a concentration camp. You know, I mean, if they would give a statehood to the Palestinians, even if it was tiny, you could at least start moving forward. But they don't. They never will. Really, all if you read Expulsion of the Palestinians, Mursala's great book, you can see that, you know, the trajectory to genocide is absolutely clear. They are just getting rid of them as fast as they can. They know they have a PR problem in terms of the world, so they have to do it slowly, incrementally, but they just one step after another, you know, I mean, you've seen the maps of the areas where in Judea, where the or Palestine, you know, where they can exist, it shrinks every year. And then the Jews in America then lecture us on racism, which I've always found odd.
The ADL said in a guide for pro-Israel activists on the website that the idea of binationalism, Jews and Palestinians sharing a state in Israel, is unworkable given the current realities and historical animosities and amount to nothing less than an indirect attempt to bring about an end to the state of Israel as a national homeland of the Jewish people. With historically high birth rates among the Palestinians and a possible influx of Palestinian refugees and their descendants now living around the world, Jews would quickly become a minority within the binational state, thus likely ending any semblance of equal representation and protection, the ADL said. Jeez.
There would be no equal representation.
In this situation, the Jewish population would be increasingly politically and potentially physically vulnerable. Oh, really? What about diversity as our strength? Same organization is condemning Scott Adams. Now, Scott Adams was responding to a poll indicating that almost half of American Blacks think that it's not okay to be white, meaning you shouldn't exist, I guess. That's how you can interpret that. And he simply said, I don't want to be around people who think this way. He was responding to a very disturbing poll. Now, of course, the response of the system is to cancel Scott Adams, who's kind of cancel proof at this point. He's worth $75 million. He's kind of semi-retired anyway. So he has what you call FU money. And he kind of admitted that. He said, this is the price you pay for free speech in this country. But he's responding to that poll and also all the other data points we see about Black and white violence, all the agitation. And so Blacks have been, you know, engineered or agitated into the state, you know, and of course you have the crime issue. And he's responding to this. And that what he said wasn't a rant. He was rather fairly calm about what he said. A rant is when you're yelling and you're irrational and emotional. He was calm. And he just kind of said it, you know, whether you agree with him or not. It was not a rant. But he's responding to evidently a very racist opinions among Blacks. Do you think that would be the issue, as opposed to Scott saying, "I just don't want around. I don't want to." Basically, what Scott said that was, Scott Adams said was, "I don't want to be around people who don't think I have a right to exist."
Yeah, that's really extreme position.
Sorry, is that racist? Yeah. It's not racist. And
people who are being promoted to violence by the media.
People like Lori Lightfoot, Kimberly Fox.
If you look at the movies, that inevitably they'll have some Black guy killing a white guy. It's just standard in all kind of action films these days, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look at Quentin Tarantino, he just slaughters white people.
Yes.
So, you know, so this is programming. They want the race war. They want to promote the race war in blacks against whites because they know that, you know, at the end they can, you can get more greater and greater control. And then beyond that, because it's reducing European Americans to the second class citizenship that we've discussed, where, you know, we don't expect to have any rights. And from that position, they can just breed us out of existence, you know, abort us out of existence. There's just various, you know, trajectories, all of which end up with us disappearing.
Yeah, that was, I sent you that link to Bill Maher's little rant on Real Time about trigger alerts or trigger warnings. And it was a typical Bill Maher thing. It was kind of funny, but he talked about these words that can't be used on campus, how people are snowflakes now, that they're afraid to hear any competing or ideas or differing ideas, what they, you know, what they believe, how people shouldn't be so sensitive, like things like warning about violence in plays or disclaimers or warnings about classic movies like Dumbo, you know, and these things. And of course, he's talking about, you know, minorities, racial minorities, so-called sexual minorities, women having these trigger alerts, or they're triggered by expressions, you know, like you're killing it, or balls to the wall, or oddly enough, virgin, whatever. These are, a lot of this silly stuff is on college campuses. It's kind of filtered into the corporate environment. And yeah, again, I understand what he's saying, but once again, he's not incorrect as he is insufficient. He falls short of the real target, because there appears to be one demographic that's not afforded trigger warnings, particularly white Christian males or heterosexual men. Why are they ignored in all this? Well, I think I know why, because part of that trigger warning stuff is a part of sort of the emasculation of society and the sort of the ability, the impose a system where people can't express themselves freely, can't resort to humor or expression, can't criticize. But the only group that isn't afforded any trigger warning or special status are white Christian males. And now, why is that? Could it be the authoritarian personality at work here?
It looks that way to me. And it's just actually, when you point it out, it's so glaringly apparent, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone else gets trigger warnings. They all have trigger for everything, mm-hmm. but we get nothing. I mean, why don't we have like a trigger warning against, there's going to be an assault on your history, you know, based on some people's opinion about Europeans that'll be in this film. I mean, if they had stuff like that, Tim, you'd never get to roll the actual movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many triggers, because the whole films are basically designed to, you know, so often just designed to debase your Christian culture, that there isn't anything other than triggering events in the entire film. In fact, you know, I was actually having a discussion about this. I really am of the opinion that the entire media should just be destroyed. I know, you know, this people are saying, well, you know, you have the First Amendment. And I say, yeah, of course. And I wouldn't want to interfere with that. But our media is so infested with propaganda at this point, and very subtle and cleverly designed propaganda, that you really can't participate in it without a crime occurring. Because remember, you know, propaganda is a kind of crime. I mean, it's subtle. It's a little abstract. But basically, they are damaging your mind. It's a kind of racism, to mm-hmm. be exact. And under the hate crime laws, all of the show business should be held accountable. And we should just get rid of all of it, every single bit, shut every studio down, end the networks, just get rid of everything other than the independent media, because there is just nothing about it that is not criminal. You know, I mean, look, you know, the reporting on the Ukraine, mm-hmm. You know, the what kind of reporting is there concerning like violence in Chicago, right? I mean, what is the, and then of course, look at the movies, the debased, whether, you know, they're not debased, that's giving them too much credit. They're all just propaganda devices to wreck Christian culture.
Yeah, there's a show called The End of Us, about zombie apocalypse. And basically it's just a promoting homosexuality, of course, because that's who survives the zombie apocalypse are homosexuals. And there's also a character, a young girl who's the actress is an adult, but she plays a minor and she has a sexual experience in the show.
Yeah, I actually was asked about it. It's not my cup of tea, but I was asked about it to comment on it and I'm going to. And I will first point out the symbolism. You know, I've talked about the symbolism in zombie movies. Mm-hmm. There are two individuals. One is named Ellie and the other is named Joel. And Joel, and these are Hebrew names. Joel means the Yahweh is God, or it just means Judaism. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. the religion, you know. So Joel is the one individual. And then Ellie means bright or light. And they have this this expression that they post throughout the event, where it says, "If you're lost in the darkness, look to the light." Right. And at the beginning of it, they have this thing painted on the wall, and then there's this little 14-year-old girl, Ellie, the light. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's this Illuminati kind of symbolism, in which the Christians are being lampooned as zombies. And I've talked about this, you mm-hmm. know, often, where, you know, this is a slurring against the Eucharist, right? So this is how they characterize Christians and how they manifest them as zombies. So here, you know, you've had this thing being repeated, and, you know, this is she actually, Ellie asks Joel how he feels about killing zombies. You have a hard time. And he goes, sometimes I do. But I mean, this is all just, you know, done to program people to disassociate from humans, particularly anyone sick or having any kind of physical problem, and just, you know, be able to feel better about murdering them. And then they had graphic homosexual
yes.
sex acts, right? So this is just a delightful family entertainment, right?
So which is more disgusting, that or like when a zombie's devouring somebody?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And so the whole thing is just to lead people into a shattered, you know, damaged mind. Yeah, The End of Us. And of course, look at the name of the show, right? And the two people who created it, it's based on a game. It was a video game, you know, because they want you to play these games so you can actually kill zombies yourself, not just watch it on TV. So then you can go out and kill, you know, the zombies you're going to be meeting here.
Are there homosexual scenes in the video game?
I don't think so. I mean, I tell you the truth, I haven't played the video game. I don't play those things. I know that in the article I read about it, it did say that, you know, the film was based on it and gave an example of some of the films, the parallels between the film and the video game.
Yeah, it was The Walking Dead, a comic book?
Yeah. I think so. But anyway, the two guys who created this are shockingly two Jewish guys, with Joel and Ellie. And, you know, it'd be interesting to have a little questioning of them concerning the symbolism and the cultural debasement, just to see if they would fess up to the fact that what they had created was a weapon to, you know, really damage the minds of Europeans, and also to lampoon. I mean, remember, they're not just here to damage us. They want to create legacy. The people who created this vicious and, you know, crazed presentation, they have, you know, these two guys, one of them is Druckerman or something. Anyway, they have a kind of bloodlust and insanity to actually want to bring something like this out. I mean, they are, you know, I don't recommend people watch it. I did watch a couple of the episodes and was just, you know, disgusted. But
I saw it on YouTube, two men kissing. I was like, okay, that's it.
Yeah, I could see what they were doing. But anyway, so it's...
It's a shock that you allow Jews control entertainment and media, they they're not going to be too solicitous or careful about the sensibilities of Christians.
Right.
And that, not only that, they, it gets no regard. In fact, again, go back to my, about the Bill Maher rant, is the only group that does not get there's any consideration for their sensibilities or sensitivities or feelings are white Christians, particularly white Christian males.
We can't be triggered because we don't exist.
Yes. You know, again, it goes back. A lot of people control the media and movies. They're going to control the entertainment and media fair information in the country. Don't be surprised they use it to wage war on their ethnic enemies. And that's
right. Why should anyone be shocked?
Shocked exactly. by it.
It's well, also, I mean,
power politics. I mean,
you read Authoritarian Personality. I mean, mm-hmm. we should probably read the conclusion of the Authoritarian Personality to see how specific and how clear cut the attack against Europeans is that has been designed by the Jews is.
Yeah, that's why fighting fascism now means making sure that people who hold traditional views regarding sexual morality or family are fascists. So
yeah,
before you know, so.
You did an interview this week, I think, what is his name, Prince? I forget his name. It was the interview that you did with that gentleman. And at the beginning of it, you had a series of audio quotes. And one of them, I think, was from Hefner.
Yeah, that was with John. That was with John Friend.
I'm sorry. And anyway, it was a very good interview. And at the beginning, you had these audio quotes, and you had Hefner actually talking about how we haven't really come far enough. There's so much sexual superstition that we have to overcome. I mean, when you think of how obvious what a lie this is. When you think of the destruction of the family that's going on real time when he makes that comment, right? These people are just evil beyond anything. I mean, really, Hefner purported to be, I think, it wasn't Jewish, but
I think it was Methodist.
Methodist, yeah.
But Playboy is full of Jews, though. I mean,
I know. I would just bet if we did a genetic test on him that we would find that EB1B, I think he would be a converso family, you know. But anyway, the quote was just wonderful. It was just so clear that you were dealing with not just, just this stupid, philosophy of Playboy, but you're dealing with evil, right? I mean, it was just transparent.
Yeah, as if everyone can live like life on the Playboy mansion.
Yeah.
One man walking around with his robe open half the day, chasing women a third his age. Really, that's a good design. That's a good setup for society. That'll...
Sure it is. Sure it is. That's where you can get your philosophy and your culture from.
It turns out he used to use those women as drug mules anyway. They had to be back at the mansion like by 9 p.m. They were slaves. Yeah.
Yeah, they were slaves. So, and then you had sex with Hefner, this kind of smelly old man. It was disgusting.
And became more absurd as the years went on, right? I mean, when his admiral sat in his robe.
It became ridiculous. Just disgusting. So
not so sophisticated in the end, did it?
I've been looking at some of the TikTok stuff, and you'll have these like women who have these chats, and very interesting because they will chat about their sex life. In other words, they're part of, to get, I guess, attendance for these reels, they have to be graphic. They're really pornographic. They describe in detail their sex. But then because they are in discussion about themselves, after they get past the pornographic revelation about the graphic details of sex they have, they talk about their lives. And I've seen like, I don't know, three or four of them now. And they all talk about how sad it is that courtship is gone, that there's not a courtship.
Well,
and you're thinking, well, gee, girls, maybe if you wouldn't talk about your graphic sex life on public communication, that there would be more of a chance to have courtship. I mean, perhaps, you see, this is the thing, how intellectually debased here, because they don't realize that, it just contradicts the possibility of a relationship in the future. You can't bring pornography into a family.
When you have sexual liberation and have what you call hypergamy, where women can pursue any man married, engaged, whatever, which you don't have a situation where men, all men, have greater access to all women and vice versa. What you have is basically the formation of harems, where the alpha male gets many women and the beta male and on down get no women. So, because they all want to go for the alpha male. In a situation of monogamy, where that's enforced or imposed culturally, legally, what have you, women have to, quote, settle for a mate. It kind of works itself out into knowing you go out and whoever proposes to you, whoever you accept, but it's not as if you can go out and get any man. And this is sort of Brown from Cosmopolitan. What was her name?
Helen Gurley Brown.
Helen Gurley Brown said, you know, the Cosmo Girls, is you can go out and pursue any woman and all that. I mean, pursue any man, whether he's taken or not. Well, again, what happens is a few men get a lot of women, and a lot of men don't get any women. So you have a situation of harems, which you would get in a polygamous society. And in a situation of polygamy is not as if that all men get a lot of women. That's never going to work out. A few wealthy men and powerful men or really attractive men get a lot of women, and a whole bunch of men don't get any women. That's not a recipe for societal stability. You see, like in the Middle East, we have polygamous societies.
And you've pointed out many times that our sex education is inherently flawed because it doesn't talk about morality as part of sexuality, right? You'd never get that in a sex ed class.
You get a mechanistic. No, you get that anymore because they're so confused about that.
Sex ed is like now.
Now it's like there's no purpose to it. There's no logos or logic or a function or mechanics to it because it's whatever you want it to be. It's just some sort of titillation or stimulation.
It's just a complete breakdown of
sterile and meaningless. Yeah.
And so this is, they do not ever discuss, when they're training, you and how to perform anal sex. I don't mean to be graphic, but Tim, this is where we are, I can show you the Santa Barbara high school texts, what training people, with. So this is our world.
This was pointed out when the school board, you have a parent show up and starts reading a book that's in the school library part of the curriculum. And the person in school says, this isn't appropriate for this audience, but it's appropriate for kids.
Right. to be training them in sex education. So anyway, so you have... they have sex education in a literal form where they literally are just showing you all the different variations of it. And as they define it, it's infinite. They don't mention that this leads to axiomatically to a completely isolated life, right? They don't mention this. They don't mention that if you engage in this kind of sexual activity, I'm not just singling out homosexuality. I'm just talking about the pornographic.
The whole point of homosexuality is that people adopt a homosexual outlook, and that isn't necessarily sodomy or sex with sexual activity. It's the idea you should engage in a series of endless, sterile, fruitless sexual relationships.
Right. And every one of those
you rob your soul. Yeah.
Everyone that you engage in, like you say, it just robs a little bit of your soul and makes it less likely you're ever going to have a relationship.
Yes, and particularly with women.
Yeah,
because they get psychologically scarred much in these things because, for a lot of reasons, they have a lot more to protect. Obviously, paternity is guaranteed by the fidelity of the woman. And so that speaks to the nature of the relationship, whereas men propose, women dispose, women decide. And that's that dance. That's courtship, which you ruin when you go on TikTok and talk about your graphic sexual experiences with multiple men.
And that's exactly right. Yeah. And so
there was a, I was listening to an old talk by Bishop Fulton Sheen. Remember him, the TV?
Sure.
Yeah, he was talking, this was probably from the early 70s, and it's a high school graduation, and it's a Catholic school, and it's girls on one side, boys on the other, they're graduating, and he's congratulating them, and he's just giving them advice on life. And he says, boys, go out there, prove you're worthy for these women. Make the bet most of yourself, be a provider, all that, respect them. Then he goes to the girls and he says, girls, make these boys be better men. He says, and he goes something to the effect, you have to understand with boys, is a boy can fall apart, can fall in love with a part of you.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's, so it's what you show. He's basically, he's telling them to be modest, you know, and chaste and disciplined, and basically it's their responsibility to make the men behave better. Because the sexual revolution, what really happened was it convinced women to drop all standards and misbehave, and convinced the men just follow right along when that happens.
You know? Yeah, I mean, pornography was really aimed at destroying sexual selectivity of females. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, when you have that, and that's what the graphic aspect of pornography is designed to do. It takes away all mystery, all romance.
Yeah.
And the woman is really, you know, I mean, I hate to.
And also real satisfaction, because it's got, if you look at pornography or pinup girls or these things, that's not how women really look like. It's not reality. So if that's your standard, you're never going to be satisfied with the real thing or the person you're with, because like, you're always looking for the better thing, as they say. You know, so.
Tim, you spun my mind talking about Bishop Sheehan, because I actually watched him. You know, this was during the era when I was a Catholic. I was an altar boy, Latin Mass, which of course reveals my age. I'm going to be 74 here in a couple months, which is kind of an interesting age. But I have been I've been charmed by a gift I've been given, kind of a pre-birthday gift. It's an app which calculates the odds of me being alive at any particular point in the future. And so, this person wanted to know if next year I wanted to go on this fishing trip. And I said, let me check the app. I said, well, I've got 82% of being here. So,
all right.
let's go for it. You know, so it's really, but I'm charmed by the app, and I run it every day. And you know, it changes. If you lose weight, you know, you get a few more days and stuff, you know. So it's like you have to put all your data in. And anyway, so the thing is, our time on Earth is very short and very precious. And, you know, I have a different position on religion, I think, than Tim does, but I absolutely believe that you have to live with logos. This is completely correct. And if you don't have it, you will not be able to enter. Basically, when your app says, you know, you've got a 2% chance of being alive in a week, you're not going to feel like you've lived much of a life, you know.
Well, like I said, whether or not you believe in heaven, it's certainly not following creates a hell on earth.
You better believe that, brother. Yeah. You better believe that.
It's practical reason is another term for it. I mean,
it's the best life. Yeah. This is the thing, is that it isn't just a moral life or the idea of like, well, an afterlife, you know, is going to be good for me. This is the best life. There really isn't, you know, at my antiquated position, I can actually look back with some authority here, because I've seen the different, you know, I was 18 years old in 1967 during the Summer of Love. Mm-hmm. I was there. I was a victim. Drugs, sex, that stuff was there for me. And I can tell you, it led to a worse life during that period. It wasn't really until I was able to organize myself and finally get married that I actually began to have happiness. And I wasn't such a, you know, just filled with, you know, negative emotions. So, you know, I don't mean to proselytize. Everyone has to live their own life, but I just would say, you know, Tim, I am in complete agreement with you that you need to live in this in a structure of logos where you are thinking of the moral the higher purpose that is there for all of us to, if we just, you know, want to walk into it, because it, for no other reason, your life is going to be a lot better. The pornographic male. I know a bunch of these guys. Well, most of the people that I knew who went that route are dead. There's your solution. Mm-hmm. They all died in their 60s, you know.
Yeah, E. Michael Jones says that he was of that generation, born 1948, and he was on his way to Woodstock, and I think in a Volkswagen Beetle with his future wife, and then a car broke down and wasn't able to make it. And they got married instead or something. And he says, it's the best thing he ever did because he avoided all that craziness because he was married. And once you get married, you're worried about a job and there's a kid on the way and all that nonsense. So in his 20s, he was already a responsible adult and everyone around him kind of went insane. And he was spared all that by getting married and just doing the right thing. And, kind of all that nonsense that were thrown at people in the late 60s and early 70s ruined Woodstock, so many people. Yeah.
Woodstock was 3 days in which they tried to define a generation.
Yeah, they say that. Jewish promoters said that.
Yeah. They tried to define a generation as debased and hating logos and multicultural. And I mean, and of course, you know, they've glamorized it with videos of the rock stars with the stupid songs, but the kids are, I mean, think about it. You know, they're not going anywhere morally, and not just that. There's no kind of progression of intellect or soul or even the ability to enjoy themselves. They're just sitting there mesmerized in a trance. So many of them are on drugs and listening to the most stupid music that's ever been produced. Ridiculous.
Again, what it was these rock festivals were outdoor mind control operations. These were mass situations that Wilhelm Reich wrote about.
Yeah.
And how you break down the inhibition. Well, people will naturally, if they're in intimate situations or on their own, they're going to feel guilty. But you expose them to a mass situation where everyone else is doing it, then you can sort of do it without any shame and rationalize it. And then the guilt that eventually emerges becomes, you know, like the raging feminist who's celebrating the killing of unborn children or these things, or the gay rights protester who's showing up in a crowd of his fellow homosexuals. And they were out there protesting together. And again, feeling the camaraderie of the crowd, they can meld into the crowd. It's the safety of the crowd, and they don't have to deal. So, and then their guilt is manifested in sort of radical politics, and you know.
They really went after the boomer. You know, you have to think about all of this. I mean, there are many points of the agenda to the counterculture, the 60s counterculture, but one of them was just to stop the baby boom, because they could see that this demographic was growing. And that this represented a political threat against the Judeo-Masonic control, because most of the boom in the baby boom were Irish Catholics. It was mostly Catholics. Mm-hmm. And then think about the things that they threw in front of that generation. Well, the two prongs were, one was the Vietnam War and the other was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Yeah. But both of those things had the same effect on the birth rate. And my generation went from families that, I had, eight brothers and sisters, then my generation had six children, I think, but among all of them, you see. Mm-hmm. So this is, they were successful with operations against us, you know, because, during the Vietnam War, of course, that's, depopulation. But it's also shattering the minds. I mean, so many of these kids came back. They weren't able to, restart their lives and produce families, I mean, some were, but it was just, obviously they reduced it down dramatically. So, we need to look at these things as a tax on us and try to figure out ways to reverse this or to have events that will actually have the opposite effect, Think of the optimism and kind of esprit de corps that actually led after the war that led to the baby boom. I mean, what can we do to bring that about?
Yeah, but how'd you get the baby boom without a lot of sex?
Search me.
Look at how they kind of describe the 50s. What was that movie Pleasantville in the late 90s?
Where yeah.
They go back in time and everything's gray because people aren't having illicit sex. And the moment they have illicit sex, they become colorful or something.
And of course, it's not just the sex, but like the street I lived on a middle-class street in Lanada Bay, which is a suburb of, Los Angeles, after we came back from Japan. And there were, like 20 houses on either side of the street. They all had families. Mm-hmm. There was a relationship between the man and the woman. There was a relationship. Every single house had a relationship. I talked to a friend of mine's daughter who was graduating from Davis, UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And this was like 10 years ago. And I was asking her demographic data. And I was asking, how many people you know are getting married? You know, what is your, and she said there wasn't any. She said zero. There's no one that's even close to it. They're that kind of relationship. So all of them were walking into loneliness and they didn't understand it, you know. But that wasn't the way, and that wasn't going on in the late 50s and early 60s. It was just the opposite. There was a relationship in every house, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And well, that's why you have the drop off in the population in the West.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess you can say it's ironic, but it really isn't, because you can see how it works is once you introduce, you know, free love and sexual liberation, what are you liberating yourself from? Oh
yeah, and then
the bonds of relationships and families, which is then atomizing your lonely.
With Lori Lightfoot, you know, her appearance, she became such a gargoyle.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I mean, what was in back of that? Do you think that they actually had some kind of handler who said, you know, we want to make you look inhuman because this is
almost appears that way. Now, obviously, some people are better looking than others, they're genetically less than or not. And sometimes
she looks very, very sweet. Have you ever saw pictures of her before the transition? Did you ever
see that? I mean, but she made herself to be.
There was some, I mean, just wondering, what do you think, was it, was she handled or just bad hair year? I mean, what exactly happened there? You know?
Well, you see that with a lot of young girls who will, you know, will stop trying to be feminine and they look awful and they you wouldn't recognize them. It's the cult of ugly, because they're not really out there. Or traditionally, a woman would try to look her best to attract a mate, and then if they're not in that game, in fact, they're almost out of spite, they're trying to look unappealing, you know. And right now you have so many social cues out there to be so confused, you know, like with gender dysphoria, which is now being openly encouraged, and transgenderism, which is being openly suggested and encouraged in the school. It's you had that one school where 10 fifth graders were transgendered in one class. Obviously, they're being groomed. They're being led down that that by the instructor or instructors. And I think it was in Missouri, and there was an investigation. Well, what do you think is going to happen if you start talking about this stuff? And especially if you create a situation where you get a certain amount of attention, status for being supposedly different.
They're promoting it. It's the cool kid. It's the special kid. You know, this is you'll want to go this route.
Especially if females will do that. Younger girls will fall for that because it's attention.
But it's just the most evil thing that's ever.
Well, no, this is that goes back to sexual education. We're not just talking about what's taught in the schools. It's also the messages they get in the media. They're watching The End of Us. They're watching shows on cable television or on the on streaming that are proposing all this stuff to young impressionable minds at 30. They're being assaulted and molested at age 13, 14, 15, watching this stuff on television. They're suggesting this stuff to grade school children now. So it's openly grooming. Get all that confusion. Yeah. And then you have the home life. This is something that was foreseen in the Jaffe memo. You create destabilized homes, you create a lot of children that are open to be traumatized. Then they don't have any healthy models for healthy sexual relations. Unless they can point to mom and dad, or they have, you know, their house is full of siblings, so they can understand the difference between male and female as you grow up. This is what you get in a big family, you know.
Right. So the, you know, obviously homeschool, there's nothing else you can do. There's no choice at this point. And then don't let the kids have smartphones. I mean,
that's another thing.
I mean, I would not let anyone have a smartphone until they had a year, a gap year after high school would be the first time I'd even consider it, because they, without, you know, enough education and knowledge of who you are, you're just so vulnerable. See, this is, you know, giving smartphones to kids who are like 5 and 6 years old is just insanity. It's, I mean, and then you wonder why they are curious about, you know, what it would be like to be a girl or something, you know, if you're a boy. So these are just commonsensical, you know, propositions. You cannot let the kids have one. There's no way to control the thing once they have it in their hands. The parental controls are just ludicrous, you know. they're ludicrous. The kids are too smart. They get around them in 5 minutes, you know. So,
well, this speaks to the media and the authorities, meaning there's no adult in room to say, you cannot broadcast this. You can't promote this. I don't care how much money you think you can make. You can't, prey upon the minds of young children. Even if you make a buck, you shall not do this. And if you do this, you know, we're gonna come down hard on you. But there are no adults in the room, evidently. You know who?
Well, there are, but they're all groomers.
Yeah, responsible adults. Now they're groomers, and because they've let a certain type group of people take over the media. And take over, you know, the laws and, you know, what's considered acceptable laws, like decency. They can't even have things like decency laws. There was a time when they'd have to consider the sensibilities of the public. Now they're dedicated to offending the sensibilities of the public, you know.
And pushing, destroying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the expression suicide machine. It's not a suicide machine. It's a murder machine.
You can stream porn, but you can't say, you can't use things like
you can't say, well, there's too much Jewish political power or too much Jewish media power. I mean, this is these are obscenities. Whereas if you ask a 5-year-old if you would like to be a boy and have surgery to get that accomplished, this is fine, no problem there. So
a function of Jewish power. Then you can say things like, we have unlimited streaming porn on the internet now. Obviously, Hollywood and entertainment is producing all manner of smut and perverse material for everyone to watch. And it's, of course, it's controlled, these networks and the studios are controlled by Jews, and they're doing that. And if you say Jews are doing it, what are you, anti-Semitic? No, I'm saying they're doing it. So that's not even in dispute anymore.
Right. And again, the language is important, because the term Jews, and they are Jews, right? Mm-hmm. But you just have to always at least make the point that it isn't Jews taking a vote, you know, to like put these things out. The people who are doing this are Jews. We are not trying to talk about the entire racial or ethnic or cultural aspect of Judaism. In other words, you can say there are a lot of Jews that are not involved.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is, it's just like the idea of the mafia, when the idea was that they were Sicilian. This wasn't so much just they were all Sicilians were involved. It was just that ethnicity was a component of the secrecy.
Yeah.
And this is now, as we talked about yesterday, unfortunately, this goes deep down into Jewish culture, mm-hmm. because if it didn't, you would have righteous Jews standing up against this.
You'd right? have righteous Jews with institutional power, which evidently you don't.
Exactly. Where are they? Where are they saying, you know, we've got to stop these people? They're as cowed as the Europeans, you know, who are the victim of all these things.
Well, when talk about the, you know, Jews, talking about the ADL. So, we're talking about the American Jewish Committee. We're talking about the mega group. We're talking about Hollywood. We're talking about the leaders and presidents of major Jewish organizations, the Jewish billionaires. These are the people that form Jewish opinion. They represent the Jewish people. And that they exist as a political body.
That's right. That's right.
So,
yeah.
So you cannot subtract them from the equation and pretend to understand what the situation is. And they're in control of these institutions, and they're using them for their perceived interest, and they're promoting particular agendas. That much is self-evident, clear by looking at it. Now you can say, well, you can't ban them because of the First Amendment. Well, then, fine, but the problem is they're violating the First Amendment using their institutional power. So we don't have a First Amendment. So what situation do we have here then? It's not reality.
Yeah.
It's like we don't have free speech. You know, when ADL can shut you down.
Yeah, we don't have the critical, category of reality.
Well, they with subterfuge or psychological warfare, ethnic warfare, social engineering, they destroy the institutional resistance, the ethnic identity and consciousness, which actually put a restraint on them the past 100 years. And without the, you know, without that institutional restraints anymore. Now they're just, you know, they can just produce whatever they want. Evidently they do now.
Yeah, they can just wage warfare, you know, by deception in any way that they want, because to call them on it, they will immediately put you into the category of anti-Semitic, you know, which is a very well thought out plan and intellectual structure to make it impossible to resist the attack. You know, this next couple years are going to be critical, no doubt, because of the, you know, because of the corona vaccine damage that we're going to be experiencing. And I think also because of all of these elements that can be used to depopulate, you know, food, energy, and of course, war. So it's a really good time, don't you think, Tim, to have the useful categories of reality available inside your mind?
Yeah, like I said, it is a category error. And that's what I was arguing with someone in my family over the weekend, over this weekend about this. Talking about Jews, and so they're not Jewish, they're liberal. I said, well, no, Jews use liberalism to promote their interests. Conservative Jews would use conservatism to promote Jewish interests, and liberal Jews would promote liberalism to promote Jewish interests. So it's not just liberalism. A good example, I said, Chuckie Schumer supports abortion on demand in the United States, but doesn't support it in Israel. Where's the principle there? Why is that? And I said, that immigration issue, I said, it's a liberal principle to support mass immigration, supposedly, but Jews don't support mass immigration when it comes to Israel because it doesn't support Jewish interests. It does support Jewish interests in when it's applied to white, formerly Christian nations, because they think by promoting mass immigration, you destroy cultural or ethnic homogeneity in the country, which helps them because that way they don't have to deal with any strong dominant ethnic group in control for resources. So it's ethnic warfare. So they're liberal. If they're liberal about immigration, they'd be liberal about Israel too, and they're not. And then, you know, so again, it's promoted to promote their interests. And yeah, that's why
you can point out the hypocrisy, but you can also point out the agenda by just using the example of Israel. It's so clear cut.
Yeah.
The racism and the genocide. Well, you know, you're opposed to these things. Well, apply it to yourself, for heaven's sakes. And of course, it's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, I mean, you know, it's integration with dark-skinned people here, but for heaven's sakes, not in Israel.
Yeah, it's a diversity for ye, but not for thee, as I say.
Not for thee, right. So, you know, the double standard is clear-cut, and the purpose and back of it is also clear-cut. It's, you know, it's just these are the things that we're dealing with, and, you know,
Have been Jews to call this out. There's like Benjamin Friedman, who gave that speech in 1961. He was a convert. There's Brother Nathaniel, who's a convert to Orthodox Christianity. He's Jewish. There's Gilad Altman, who is not a convert, but he's very, you know, Zionism. There's a lot of Paul Eisen, I think, is one who's called out the Holocaust. You know, so, but again, so when, you know, when we say, obviously, when we say the Jews are talking about the entity, the political, the people, the Jews, not talking about everyone. No one, we never use that language. I mean, obviously, like when we say, well, the Catholics, we don't mean every Catholic. Exactly. We're talking about the Vatican, the Church. Exactly. We're talking about the Russians. Well, we're talking about the Russians as represented by Vladimir Putin and the Russian state. Or when we say Germany invaded Poland in 1939.
Yeah, it's a shortcut because to actually to categorize the precise, you know, like these individuals who are all Jews who are involved in the media, you would not be ever be able to finish a paragraph. Mm-hmm. You know? So the Jews in Hollywood.
But when over 400 Jewish organizations come out and call abortion an essential Jewish value, that of which if you don't have an abortion on demand, you're violating their free exercise of religion. First of all, I didn't know there's as many as 400 self-identifying Jewish organizations in the United States, which says a lot. But they come out and saying, you know, they're all for abortion. Well, obviously, you can say, well, the Jews are for abortion because the major.
And how many I'd love to know. It'd be so great to categorize how many of them are for transgender rights and for transgender.
Well, the ADL is intersectional, therefore transgender rights, immigration. You know, I was listening to someone talk about in Ireland, a place talking about mass immigration, and the same people who promote mass immigration are for transgender rights and gay rights. So you get the same intersectionality, and overwhelmingly in Ireland of our places, they have a disproportionate representation of Jews doing this, spearheading this.
Isn't it strange? And then yeah. to have this kind of intellectual DNA always be the same. And then you stand back and you go, you know, what really characterizes all these different streams of intellectual structure is the fact that they all lead to the genocide of the European. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something we can talk about? Because, you know, abortion, transgender, you know, kind of the multicultural, I mean, all of these things end up in the same place. And who's going to run that world? Who's going to have control? Well, it isn't going to be us.
Well, again, if you look at whether it's psychoanalysis and Freudianism, that was an assault on European Christian culture. Freud said as much. He said he was a latter day, you know, what's that general?
Maccabee. Hannibal. Judas Maccabee.
Hannibal.
Oh, no, he said he was Hannibal. Yeah,
that's he was Hannibal, assaulting the, you know, the gates of Rome. Yeah. And Franz Boas' sociology, Jewish, there you have, feminism, these things, that was a Jewish proxy operation from the start. So all these things are assault on, you know, Western Christian Europeans as it is. I mean, that's what it is. That's what they're opposed to. Yeah. In the 1950s, Eisenhower had a commission on immigration, and it was dominated by Jews. And they said, well, America's ethnic makeup really isn't an issue. It doesn't matter as long as, you know, they all believe in American ideas. But then they come out, then they support mass immigration of non-Europeans or non-white Europeans. Why is that? If it doesn't matter, why are you proposing it?
Why
are you proposing it?
Exactly.
Then they get Hart Celler 10 years later.
Yeah.
In 1965, and they start pouring in. And then, you know, except if it doesn't matter, you know, if it doesn't matter what ratio, then why is it like you're watching BBC and they have a show about Elizabeth the First, and Elizabeth is a black woman?
Right. It doesn't matter. So, well, if it doesn't matter, why don't you portray history as it existed?
Yeah. Well, no, does, I mean, it does matter because, first of all, it doesn't. I don't understand if it's an adaptation. Like, say, you can adapt Shakespeare to Japan if you want, and vice versa. A good example is, you know, you have the Seventh Samurai and you have the Magnificent Seven. Obviously, it would be absurd to have Japanese in the Magnificent Seven. It would be absurd to have cowboys in the Seventh Samurai. That's an adaptation of the Seventh Samurai applied to the American West. So that's not, you know, that's not, you know, culture appropriation. That's not stealing the story. That's appropriate. I'm talking about if you're supposed to be a historical piece, a period piece, and it takes place in Elizabethan England, and it's full of blacks, that's ridiculous.
Tim, I have a Seven Samurai story. This is one of my little memories. I knew Lou Morheim. He was the director, I think the author of the Magnificent Seven, mm-hmm. you know. And obviously it was a knockoff of Seventh Samurai.
Yeah.
And it was an absolute knockoff. And so he was
much better theme music though.
Yeah, he told me the story. He says he was at a film festival and he went up to Hirakawa. I think it was
the director.
The Japanese director, you know, yeah. Famous I can't believe I can't pull his name. Anyway, so he went up to him and he goes, look, you know, I guess you saw, you know, the film. He goes, oh, yeah, I saw it. And he goes, well, you know, I just wanted to, you know, tell you I was sorry. I didn't really talk. But I, you know, obviously I took all of your ideas and I, you know, wanted to thank you. And Hirakawa. And he looked at him and he goes, well, you know, I'll tell you, I was just trying to make a John Ford Western. It's an absolute, I was just trying to make a John Ford Western. He goes, none of that stuff is Japanese.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So they get the cross pollination. That's funny.
Yeah.
But you see my point. I mean,
of course. Yeah.
There's some situation I don't care, but it's just absurd at that point. Then you notice that, you know, all the commercials have been purged of white people. And to the extent that the white people in commercials, they're the men are fools or something, or, you know, it's clear.
Yeah. I mean, you know. Quentin Tarantino, where, you know, the blacks are clever, the whites are debased, mm-hmm. and they slaughter the blacks, usually slaughter the whites. And then Tarantino says, well, this is a way for them to, you know, vet and, you know, transcend all of their hatred. Right. Right. Exactly.
Oh, just letting off steam, I say.
Well, yeah, I guess when they're just letting off steam, when you know, Anyway, so
when you look at the crime statistics, you're just letting off steam.
Yeah, and so this is cathartic. That's the actual word he used. And you know, you just go, you know, Quentin, is anyone even believing a word you say? Because don't you think that this, that your films are watched by young Black males who then go out and are more likely to be violent? There's no cathartic element here whatsoever. And so...
like those kids in Ohio that are surrounded by a Black gang and forced to kneel.
Yeah.
Ohio. So or that doctor that was stabbed to death by the guy.
I know. It's just, again, you know,
California.
Tim, you just got to shut that thing off, man. It is one lump of propaganda and just cultural destruction at this point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thank God.
Yeah, it doesn't, because you, if you say that and you create a message where all your problems are because of Whitey, you're never going to do anything to solve your own problems. Which is not ultimately necessary. I mean, you got to get your own life in order, get rid of the chaos
If you look at like the inner city and you go, well, this is a complete disaster, cultural disaster. What role has Hollywood played in this? What uplifting of these individuals with think of the attention that the Blacks are given in TV and film by the Jewish Hollywood, you know, film producers, you know. And then look into the inner city and try to find a single example of some kind of uplifting, intellectual or moral uplifting. There isn't any. It's always the other direction. They always talk about, you know, by eclipsing the whites and promoting the Blacks in these, you know, heroic but always counterculture roles that they're there to help them. This is absolute nonsense. I mean, it's like the Great Society program. You could make these cases back in the 60s, but after 70 years, you're really just trying to hurt them. And
the poverty argument just doesn't work anymore. I mean, the most honest movie I ever saw about that was ever seen Menace to Society. It was brutally honest about the pathology of the Black inner city. I mean, I remember seeing it thinking about this. I was expecting to hear a lecture or something. I just walked out of it thinking that was just brutally honest about the sort of the pathology, the nihilism, and the brutality of us. Yeah. I think there was like South Central LA, but yeah, it was. So, okay, Joe.
Tim, thanks for the discussion, and we'll get them next week, brother.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.